Stories of Adoption. As of today, there are nearly 400 foster children in Maine waiting to be adopted. Who are they? And what does it take for a willing family to adopt in Maine? I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll learn more about this very personal process and explore the system that finds loving homes for kids who need them. We'll also hear the compelling stories of people who have adopted children or been adopted themselves or both. With me in studio, Carol Welch. She's an adoptive mother who was herself adopted as a child and also gave a child up for adoption, a story she tells in her book, 360 Square, a memoir of adoption and identity. Also with us today, Linda Greenlaw. She's a swordfish boat captain and author. Her new book is Life-Saving Lessons, Notes from an Accidental Mother. And Therese Cahill Lowe joins us today. She's the director of the Office of Child and Family Services with Maine's DHHS. Join the conversation, email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, message us on Facebook, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Stories of Adoption. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Portland Ovations, presenting the Italian dance company Spellbound Tuesday, April 9th at the Westbrook Performing Arts Center, portlandovations.org, and by DN Wealth Advisors, providing independent investment advice to individuals, families, and institutions, DEIGHAN.com.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Adoption advocates say that there are thousands of kids, especially older children and children of color in the United States, who are still looking for a family of their own. Today we'll hear more about the adoption and foster care system in Maine, and we'll hear the personal stories of two women who have chronicled their stories in these books. One of them, Linda Greenlaw, perhaps best known for her experience as the captain of a commercial fishing boat, who survived the actual perfect storm. She's the author of several books, including Life-Saving Lessons. Linda Greenlaw, welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
This book tells the story of your unexpected journey into parenthood, but not under the traditional circumstances of unexpected. Give us a brief story of how it unfolded, how it happened.
All right. I like to say that the stork left a 15-year-old girl on my doorstep, and it was almost that simple. This young girl moved to the small island where I live from very far away with someone who we thought was her uncle. He became her legal guardian, and 4 years into their stay on my island home, things came to light. And we still don't know whether this young girl's biological mother had given her away or sold her to a pedophile. But long story short, her former guardian is in federal prison.
So she moved in kind of next door to you in a figurative sense. How did you end up with her? It would seem that would have to go through a court system and she'd be moved far away. And how difficult was it for you to bring
it was her? Amazingly simple. The island where I live, everyone had fallen in love with this young girl. We've had a huge problem of depopulation through the years, so year-round residents are welcomed with open arms. Here's a young girl for the school. At the time, we had four little boys in the school and, four kids in a school, not that many. The island fell in love with this little girl. Nobody wanted to see her go into the foster care program. They say it takes a village to raise a child, and on the island, it's absolutely true.
So in a lot of
everyone knows everyone's business.
In a lot of ways, the community made this much better. It was a supportive place just by the nature of the place that it is. And did it help her to adjust to this new life?
I think it did help her. It helped me adjust to the new life. We had a lot of support from the community. My friends had always been men, and for the first time in my life, I was reaching out to the women in the community. Nothing I've done in my career as a fisherman or as an author prepared me for motherhood.
Well, I was going to say, being a fishing boat captain is probably one of the most difficult and certainly treacherous jobs imaginable, and yet didn't prepare you for the challenge.
Right. And I would have said it's some of the most difficult work I've ever done until mothering a 15-year-old girl.
We'll talk more about that experience, too. Carol Welch, you have this extraordinary story in which you've experienced adoption from all angles imaginable, actually. Tell us the story, first of all, of your early beginnings and your first experience as an adopted. You were an infant at the time.
Yes, I was. I was adopted through the state system in the state of New York by very loving family that were post-war adoptive family. I grew up having most everything that I wanted, was given a good, solid background of what was right and what was wrong. And as I entered puberty, things changed. My dad had a lot of difficulty in dealing with a pubescent child, and the rules and regulations became more than I could bear, and I rebelled, which I'm quite sure was part of my genetic makeup. And that ended up, the result of that was I ended up out on the street on my own, finished high school, and went on from there.
And going on from there, it's an involved story. You become pregnant?
Yes. One of those teenage mistakes that nobody ever wants. It was certainly not something that was planned. It was during the Vietnam War, and I tried whatever I could to contact the father, but was unable to, so was left to make decisions for myself on my own without any support from family, because at this point I had been thrown out of my house.
You made a decision about that child and what that child's, with respect to what you were able to do, and I wonder if you could talk about that.
Sure. It was a very, very difficult decision. But I really didn't want to be pregnant. I knew I would not be a good mother. I had had great parents in the beginning, but I had this sort of abusive thing to overcome. And I knew that if I was going to be mother at that time, I would be abusive myself, and decided that I really needed to get on with my life and let this child have a life that I could not provide.
And then later on, you become an adoptive mother as well, completing the trifecta.
Yes. And that was an accidental mother as well, in that I had been a foster parent for a private adoption, and the physician that had facilitated that adoption contacted me and asked if I knew if the family were interested in another child. He had another young woman who was going to be relinquishing a child. And I said I would contact them, but I didn't think so. And after a glass of wine at a Christmas Eve party, I flippantly said, "And if you can't find anyone, well, maybe I'll consider it." Well, be careful what you ask for. Because the next thing I knew, we were becoming parents of an infant girl.
Right. And I want to talk more about both of those stories. Therese Cahill Lowe, from your perspective as a state official who hears a lot of stories and sees a lot of statistics, these are very different stories, but there are some common threads there. And that common thread is that there's a child often who's been through really difficult circumstances and is trying to find a landing place that's protective and safe and loving. How difficult is that? How hard is that to make that happen?
It's incredibly difficult. And I just want to say how grateful I am for people like Linda and Carol who take that chance, because it is difficult for these children to try to trust or reestablish some kind of connection to attach to another person, particularly when they've been, tossed aside or, abused in such a manner that they were treated so poorly that that's what they thought was normal. That's probably the biggest thing, is the normalization of abuse and neglect, for them to overcome that is not how we treat people. And I think that's difficult for any child to overcome.
And we have very different circumstances. So when Carol was adopted as an infant, she grows up in this environment that seems like it's her family. There's no real adjustment to make. And yet, if you're 15 and you're going through a difficult period in your life anyway, you've been traumatized, that's a very different story.
Well, maybe. I think Carol's story is interesting in that when she was 15-ish, then she, made choices and rebelled, as she said. that is the biggest, that is when most adoptions struggle, is when adolescence comes out, adoptive parents, that's when the struggle is going to be the greatest. Because even if they're a baby, when they are taking into our system, something awful has happened to them. And in the developmental stages of life, they often do remember or experience some kind of reoccurrence of that trauma during development.
Linda, can you speak to that? I don't know how much you want to talk about the personal experiences of your daughter, but maybe you could shed some light on kind of what the parents go through and the kids go through at that age in these circumstances.
Well, I know becoming a guardian of a 15-year-old girl, I mean, I'd always wanted my own children. And because of my choice of careers, I'll blame it on that, never had my own. And so I'd pretty much resolved to not having my own children. And I was okay with that. I'd come to grips with it. And then, you know, circumstances are, as I said, it was so simple. I mean, my community said, hey, Linda, you take her. You have a spare bedroom. That was all it took. And at first it was just going to be this temporary, okay, she's going to stay with me until the state figures out what we are doing with this kid. And, you know, not too long into my relationship with the girl that I do now refer to as my daughter. And believe me, it was a pretty tough 3 years. From 15 to 18, I had so many second thoughts. And I didn't even like this kid for the first 3 years. Didn't even like her. So now I can honestly say I love her, and I do feel that she's my daughter.
Is that something that changed in you, or you had to just wait it out? What happened?
I think it was a combination. We grew on each other, and all my girlfriends at the time, I was complaining, wow, God, this kid, she's driving me insane. You know, she's obstinate. Her disposition is just rotten. Yeah, she'd been through some terrible, terrible times. She had been tossed around. She had absolutely no trust of anyone. She had no idea right from wrong what was normal. When the beans were finally spilled and we all became aware of what was happening to her under the roof that she called home with her only family, which was this uncle, her question to me was, do you think he's really in trouble? Wow. I knew that some of it was wrong, but I didn't know it was like that bad. She had no idea. It was normal to
her. Her idea of normal was right. Skewed.
And when I complained to my girlfriends who, you know, had been through, you know, the raising of teenage daughters, they were, oh, you know, that's absolutely normal. You know, it might get worse. And I was like, no, you don't get it. This is not normal. So the big question became, you know, nature versus nurture. How much of this kid's behavior is due to her upbringing, and how much is just, hey, that's just the way she is? Fortunately, it's a combination of things, but she's lovely.
In terms of credibility also, maybe, I don't know of this, but I'm just going to raise it for the purpose of conversation. You had not had children. She might have looked at you and said, oh, you don't know anything about kids, clearly. Whereas Carol, you had not only experience with having a child, but you'd also been adopted. Did you have sort of extra credibility with your adopted child, or was that not an issue?
I don't know. I would have to ask her whether she saw that as, you know, valuable to her. I think certainly certain conversations we've had as with her as an adult have been.
How old is she now?
She is 29.
All right, so she's well on in her and into her life.
Yes.
What does do you think that she would consider adoption, or is she thinking about starting her own family? Or?
She actually has a son of her own, and I don't know whether she would consider adoption. I think maybe she would, considering she had a difficult delivery, but I don't think she would be opposed to it. I'm not sure that it's on her radar, though.
Therese Cahill-Lowe, who are the parents? You talked a little bit about the kids, but who are the parents that are out there looking, and are there enough of them?
I'll answer the second question first. No, there are definitely not enough of them. The parents that are the people that are generally looking are looking to adopt babies, younger children, and we need more parents who are willing to adopt the teenage. The 15-year-old girl who's going to be challenging for 3 years at least. So, no, we don't have enough. But the people who are generally looking are looking to adopt babies.
And are there – I've heard stories of, you know, these agencies that that even will try to find a child that looks like you or has similar features. That's different from the sort of the local kids in the state who are looking for a home.
Absolutely different.
And the state doesn't regulate those agencies.
No.
So it's really two different routes that you can take.
Right. I actually tried to get some information on the number of private adoptions Maine has had and couldn't get that.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you as well. 1-800-399-3566, the number again. 1-800-399-3566. Your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
Well, whether you like it or not, it's been a long winter. One thing you probably do like, though, is public radio and the fact that our last membership campaign, although a short one-day Super Thursday campaign, was way back in October. And as you know, public radio has been here throughout the winter, bringing you all the important news. There was that election, the economy, the Middle East, what's going on with Congress, the Supreme Court, because folks like you support this public radio service. Hi, Charles Beck here. We're committed to keeping our membership campaign short and as painless as possible. But it's time for another touch base, and we'll do that with another one-day, just one-day campaign, Super Thursday, April 11th. Thanks in advance for doing your part.
It's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, like you've never seen it before. And because it's a radio show, there's a good chance that's true. Here's your chance. There will be a nationwide live staging of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me that will be beamed to cinemas across the country on Thursday evening, May 2nd, including three locations right here in Maine. Host Peter Sagal and official judge and scorekeeper Carl Castle will be joined by panelists Paula Poundstone, Mo Rocca, and Tom Beaudet to play the quiz and all the other fun stuff they do in front of a live audience and you. The event here in Maine at 8 o'clock in the evening on Thursday, May 2nd, takes place at the following locations: Collins Center, University of Maine in Orono, Cinematic Grand in South Portland, and the Brunswick 10 in Brunswick, which will also present an additional showing on Tuesday, May 7th, at 7:30. Tickets are on sale now. Just like purchasing a movie ticket, you can purchase yours either at the theater location or online through various ticketing services. We'll also be giving away a few tickets to each theater over MPBN's Facebook page later in April, so stay tuned to our Facebook page for more details. We hope to see you there.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Stories of Adoption. With me in the studio, Linda Greenlaw, sword fisherman, author of numerous books, her most recent, Life-Saving Lessons, Notes from an Accidental Mother. Carol Welch, she's the author of 360 Square, a memoir of adoption and identity. And Therese Cahill Lowe, she's the director of the Office of Child and Family Services for the state of Maine. We'd like you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And we'll go to the phones in a minute. I just want to ask to the group, is it difficult for, or how often, how common is it for families to try this in all? Give it their all. Linda, you said you were at times had second thoughts and wondered, gee, can I really do this? You stuck it out for 3 years. I assume there are parents who are sincere about trying to do this, who come to a point, though, where they decide it just isn't good for anybody. And then I assume the child has to go somewhere else. Right, Therese?
Yeah. For me, that's one of the toughest things that parents must have to make a decision on. But for the child that has already been rejected by one family of sorts, is now being turned over and from a family that said that they would love them forever. So it's a very tough situation. And I appreciate you bringing it up, because what we refer to them as disrupted adoptions, they are more frequent than I think anybody wants to care to think about.
All right, let's go to Biddeford and Lisa. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
Well, actually, adoption disruption is exactly what I wanted to call and talk about, because I think it's one of it's the dirty underbelly of adoption that no one wants to talk about. And I'm really pleased to see that Therese was willing to talk about the topic. And I'd like to hear more about what Maine is doing and what Maine plans to do about the topic.
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about that. That is, as I mentioned, that's one of my major areas of concern, and I've been pretty vocal about that. We are planning to really reform some of the programs that we currently provide, because I truly believe that we need to provide post-adoptive services. We can continue to throw money at this problem, but that's not what adoptive parents are telling me that they need. They're telling me they need supports and services. And so we are looking, and you will see that we will be putting out an RFP within the next 9 months around this service in particular. There is not enough out there. And when I say post-adoptive services, I'm not talking 6 months from the time of adoption. I'm talking through the adoptive years, through the 18 years or so.
And what kind of services? You mean helping parents, both sides?
Both, but also to avoid the crisis, from it getting to a major crisis point, which is when parents decide they can't do this anymore or it's not safe for them to do it anymore.
Linda, did you come close to a crisis point in your experience?
I'm sure that my daughter and I were at the breaking point for 3 years. But I am one of these people, it's just not in my nature to quit or give up on anything, whether good or bad. And in this case, you know, it was the right thing to do. And I had a ton of support from my family, my friends. As I said, my entire community was very supportive of making this relationship work. And you know, I couldn't be happier about sticking through the bad times. And I think that my daughter would say the same thing. I'm sure she would have gladly left my house at any point in those 3 years, but she didn't have anywhere else to go.
Yeah.
So she was kind of stuck with me.
Carol, we were talking during the break that you had a second chance as well. Can you talk about that?
Right. And I also want to address Teresa's point in that I think that every adoptive child has some issues with their identity, and that is something that is not always addressed with the families and with people that are working with adoption. And that can be the source of some of the rebelliousness and some of the headbutting that goes on, is because the kids are trying to figure out who they are and they don't have all their resources.
Do you mean genetic
genetic
identity?
Resource, but just the ability to know that, you know, it's okay to feel the way you're feeling because you have been rejected. And you've been rejected on a really true core level that you may not even understand yourself.
So what kind of when we say services, that's a little vague. What do we mean by services?
Well, that's actually what I'm asking adoptive parents. So I've been meeting with some adoptive parents. My staff is out there meeting with them because I can't identify what the services that they need. I could guess, but I would rather have them tell me what would have helped you when they were 10, what would have helped you when they were 12, that kind of support.
Lisa, what would you say the services should be?
Well, as an adoptive mother and as someone who has taken in a child who was a child from a disruption, actually who had been disrupted twice, I would say that sometimes things just will not work out with a particular family. But also, I mean, I can't imagine giving up my own children. I can't imagine giving up any of the three that I have right now. And we have another one who may be entering our home very shortly. And I have a follow-up question, actually, for Therese, and that is what happens with these kids when they age out of the system where, I mean, foster care and all of that is not going to be something that they can enter into? Because these young women who are a part of my life are they made it to 18 with their families, but then their families effectively dumped them.
Yeah.
That's another major issue. We have, you know, last year 143 children aged out of foster care. That's 143 too many. And so our focus is really trying to find some permanent connection for these folks, for these young adults. Whether even when they're in adulthood, whether they're you know, a legal guardian or an adoptive family, some kind of commitment to this child, saying that I will stick by you when you're 25 and your car breaks down, that kind of commitment. So we work even with children after the age of 18. Often we work with them up until the age of 21 that we can afford, funding-wise, we can afford that. And but we know that we have connections with a foster care alumni association that's being established in Maine, and those people will be great supports because they consist of people who have been through the system, and a lot of them did not find permanency until they were in their 30s.
Yes, so, we have an email from a listener who says, please let folks know about an active group supporting adoptive families in Maine. It's MAFCA, the Maine Adoptive Family Collaborative. We're going to move along. Lisa, thanks very much for your call. We'll go now to Lovell and Liz. Hi, Liz. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. And now that I'm on, I'm a little my heart just started beating.
No, it's okay. Don't worry. You're fine.
So I just wanted to share a little bit of a story and a comment, and I have a few different perspectives on adoption. I have a brother through adoption. I have a daughter through adoption, and I also work as a nurse. In labor and delivery. So I have been involved in a variety of situations through my work. And it's a very interesting scenario now than what it was years ago. And I think that watching my brother, who was adopted from an unknown situation, watching my daughter, who knows that we have contact with her birth mother, and then talking to adults who have no sense of their identity because things were secret, I think that there can be a lot of positive growth in adoption. And hearing about the fact that you're looking to create support for adoptive families beyond the picture of just those first the first year, I guess, that makes me feel really excited about families that get into those tricky places where they're looking for support. And having these conversations in public places makes it that much more possible for people to have the conversations that support each other. And I just wanted to leave that comment with you. And
all right, Liz, thank you. Thanks for joining us today. You did fine. I do want to also – we have a Facebook message from a listener who is asking about for us to talk about the difficulty of these decisions about contacting birth parents, about finding children that have been given up. These complicated questions, are they as complicated as they used to be? Help us understand what the conventional, I guess, wisdom is, or is it all individual? Linda, do you have a sense?
I really don't have a sense of the history or if things have improved or whatever. My personal experience with my daughter is that when she first came under my care, she had quite a bit of contact on the phone with her biological mother. My listening to her end of the conversations was my opinion was that it was a very unhealthy relationship. It was hard to understand which one was the mother. Only listening to one end of the conversation. And it became clear within a year that her mother would have been very happy having her relationship with me fail. And she did some pretty rotten things. It's almost like she didn't want her daughter to even survive emotionally. Mm. So the contact's been less and less. She was 15. I couldn't make a decision for her. School vacation, she wanted to go home to see her biological family. If she'd been 3 or 5 or even 11 or 12, I may have been able to say, no way. But at 15, I had to say, if you want to go, I'll buy the ticket. These few times that she chose to go home, she came back very disappointed that she had gone.
Carol, what's been your experience in this front?
Well, just to give a little bit of history, from the 1940s on until just recently, most states had closed adoption laws. You were not able to have access to what is called your original birth certificate, or OBC. There, the American Adoption Congress, Concerned United Birth Parents, some other organizations are working very hard to alter that, and there have been some states that have changed that. Fortunately, Maine is one of them. if you have access to your original birth certificate, it is considerably easier to locate a biological family. If you do not, then you have to become a detective, play a cat and mouse games, and it can take a long time or it can take a very short time, depending on the circumstances and depending on how much information you actually have. But certainly it can be something that takes over and you don't feel complete until you have that information sometimes.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you as well. The number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Jared Diamond, the author of Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse. Diamond considers the lessons we can learn from tribal societies in his newest book, The World Until Yesterday. Join me next time for a conversation with Jared Diamond on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Join us for that at 1 o'clock, immediately following Maine Calling.
After years of dealing with his son's addiction, which he wrote about in his bestseller Beautiful Boy, David Sheff has written a new book called Clean, about the latest research into addiction and recovery. On the next Fresh Air, Sheff challenges some myths about addiction and recovery and talks about his own experiences as a parent. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program Adoption in Maine. With me in the studio, Linda Greenlaw, author of Life-Saving Lessons, Notes from an Accidental Mother. Carol Welsh, she's the author of 360 Square, a memoir of adoption and identity. And Therese Cahill Lowe, she's the director of the Office of Child and Family Services for the state of Maine. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. We'll go back to the phones now. And to Maureen. Hi, Maureen.
Hi.
Yeah. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to this conversation with great interest because I've spent the last probably 30 years of my life working as an advocate for birth, adoptive, and foster families. And for the past 3 years, I've been working quite a bit in Maine. And it strikes me that there's an element of this discussion that we really haven't focused on, and it's this, that adoption has changed dramatically in the last 40 years. There really aren't a lot of what we used to call healthy babies anymore. Folks are turning more to foster care, more to international adoption. And the truth is, all of those children are in the system because of trauma, loss, abandonment with their families of origin. And one of the concerns that I have is that as we talk about family support and we focus on supporting adoptive families, which is extremely important, I had some concerns that in Maine and some other states, but Maine in particular, kids' parental rights are terminated pretty quickly sometimes, and kids end up in the adoption system who maybe really shouldn't be there in the first place. I'm also concerned that in Maine, older children are way overrepresented among the waiting children, and I know how hard it is to recruit for that population, but I guess I'd be interested to know from Ms. Cahill what the state is trying to do to limit having children enter the adoption system in the first place, on the one hand, and on the other hand, what in particular they're doing to adopt families for older kids, because...
Yeah, Therese?
At the program I was referring to earlier, and I mentioned that the post-adoptive services, we have this program that we're establishing is a continuum of services. So the post-adoptive services are towards the end of those services. So we're looking at supporting families prior to us having to be involved. And by us supporting it means we will be contracting with community providers so that it becomes a community effort, because it is a community that keeps a child safe. And so that's what we're looking at. We're really going to be reworking a lot of our funding. We're not asking for more money for this purpose. We're using current resources and just going to do that differently to focus on families before we have to get involved.
Is there a philosophy about keeping kids in their biological home
Oh, yes.
as much as possible?
It's the law. We want to keep them in as much as possible. But I will say that there's the other side of that coin. There are plenty of people who will tell me that we're not moving fast enough. So we're never going to satisfy either side of that population. We're just trying to focus on the child who's in front of us and to determine whether or not their parents have made enough effort and enough recovery in order for them to be put back with their parents. And if that's not the case, then we can't put them back. But we do have reunifications that we try to, you know, that we try to get done, reunifying families within 18 months. Some of them will take longer, but as long as the parents are trying, we will not make children waiting for adoption.
Maureen, I'll give you a quick follow-up.
I would say that in Maine, my experience has been that the state tries to track the federal statutes, which I actually was involved in writing, which do require diligent efforts to reunify the kids on a timeline that's shorter rather than longer. But at the same time, when you start to talk about, and some of the things that Linda's addressed, which actually are of some concern to me because I'm not clear how the system was appropriately involved when she took on this young woman, these kids are not simple, but at the same time, you don't want to pathologize them. So, you know, I know that the state is probably walking a really fine line between trying to give these kids as much normalcy as possible and treating them like regular kids, and at the same time, helping families understand the real complexity of child abuse and neglect.
Yeah, let's let Linda respond to, I think, this idea that it seemed awfully simple for you to do this, I guess.
Actually, it was frighteningly simple. And that's not to say that the state wasn't involved. They were. Some representatives from Department of Health and Human Services came out to my home, and they wanted to meet with my daughter's support system. So every woman on the island, which is a very small number, was at my kitchen table that day to meet with these women, saying, we are going to support this relationship. After that, the legal part of it, we met with an attorney with the Pine Tree Legal System. It's actually an attorney representing my daughter, not me. And we went before a judge. We both said yes. We both signed a paper and went home.
Carol, has your experience been, is it that simple, or times have changed, I guess, over the years, and maybe the process has changed?
Sometimes it's simple and sometimes it isn't. It depends on the circumstances. My daughter was not adopted in the state of Maine. It was a private adoption, and therefore we had an attorney involved. And there was a home study. There was a waiting period, and it was relatively simple.
Brandon is calling from New Hampshire and has a question about cost, so we'll let him ask it as well. Hi, Brandon. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi, thank you. I know that I'm calling from New Hampshire, and you guys are discussing Maine here, but you might still be able to help. My wife and I are interested in adopting, and we're not limited to getting an infant. We'd be happy to take on anybody because we feel like we have a lot to offer. But friends of ours that have attempted to adopt before have run into so much cost that they weren't able to follow through with it. You know, huge bills and things to determine if their home was big enough and that sort of thing. And we're not homeowners, you know, but we're not below the poverty line either. And I know there's a lot of people in that economic bracket these days. I just don't know where to go. Yeah. I'd really like to be able to do this.
Sure. Anybody want to tackle that one? I assume that you have to have the right place to live and it has to be safe. And do you have to own a home, Therese?
No. We don't limit it to that. I'm pretty sure New Hampshire wouldn't either. We want loving families. Families who are going to stay in these children's lives until these children are no longer on this earth.
And what about the costs? Is this primarily legal fees, or can you talk about the cost, Linda?
Well, in my situation, I think there's probably a huge distinction between legal guardianship and adoption. So I really can't speak to the costs of adoption. Legal guardianship, the legal fees were all paid for.
Yeah. Carol?
So it was.
I'm not sure what my parents paid for my adoption. My second adoption, we simply went to court and I stood in front of a judge and told him that I wanted to be these people's child, and they said they wanted me to be their child, and therefore that was that. And I don't know as though there was more than maybe $100 fees for the court. And with my daughter's situation, again, it was a private adoption, so there were just the attorney fees, which were very reasonable.
All right. We have lots of questions about and information about services for adoptive parents, questions, answers, links, et cetera. They're all on our Facebook page, Maine Calling. Friend us. You'll be glad you did. Let's go to Laura in Bath. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, I just wanted to chime in on letting adoptees know that if they are interested in doing their searching, you probably would rather do it sooner than later, as my mother, Carol, has always been supportive for me to do the search, and I have just recently tried to do the search and found out that my mother, my biological mother, had passed away. And so I guess it kind of feels to me like I'm kind of at a roadblock. But I also want to let people know, too, just to not give up. And
all right. Laura, thanks for calling. And let's go to, let's see, let's go to Julie in Portland. We're going to try to fit as many calls as we can in here. Hi, Julie.
Hi, my name is Julie. I'm calling to share a resource that some of your listeners might be interested in, involved with a group called the Multiracial Adoptive Families Collaborative of Southern Maine. And it's a group that was created about 3 years ago by several families in response to the lack of post-adoptive services.
Right. We already shared that. We shared that link, and appreciate your call. We did share that link earlier, and again, it'll be on our Facebook page. So we appreciate you sharing that with us. Let's take one more call to Brooklyn and Michelle. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
We've got about 30 seconds.
Okay. Well, just two quick things. One is on adoption language. As an adoptive parent of a 14-year-old, the words give up for adoption or put up for adoption kind of implies, like, jam to me. And really the proper way to refer to it is make an adoption plan. You know, a biological mother puts a lot of thought into this.
Yeah, I was guilty of that. I think I picked that up from my mother in 1967 and have used it ever since. It's a point well taken, but Michelle, we're out of time because I do want to make sure that we get in that there are a couple of book signings here. Linda, you have a book signing today?
Yes, this evening, 7 o'clock, Nonsuch Books in South Portland.
South Portland. And Carol, you too?
Yes, Coffee by Design on India Street at 2:30 this afternoon.
Wow, so this is an incredible coincidence. Teresa, is there a website that people can go to the state for information?
Yes, the Adoptive Family, Foster and Families of Maine, AFFM.org would be the place to go for that information.
All right, well, thank you all for being here today. Interesting conversation. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but thanks for being on Maine Calling today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Linda Greenlaw, sword fisherman, author of numerous books, her most recent Life-Saving Lessons, Notes from an Accidental Mother. Carol Welsh, the author of 360 Square, a memoir of adoption and identity. And Therese Cahill Lowe, director of the Office of Child and Family Services for the state of Maine. Tomorrow on the program, the importance of having a will. Today's program was produced by our volunteer Scott McAuliffe and Jonathan Smith. Scott also answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board, and we had help from the MPBN web team. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.